This is really important, you guys.
Really important.
I made the date of today's show July 2nd. I'm releasing it tonight. I don't want to spend a lot of time.
No editing.
That's my goal. You'll see how it happens.
So if we can't do this in one take, you're not doing Geek Speak ever again.
That's right. It's done. Game over, man. Today's episode, Mapping Database Abuse with Better Apps. We chat about some California law. We talk about internet fraud and supercomputers. And then we have a long discussion about...
What's an app? What's it good for? What's it do for you? And how's it going to be better?
And how software's changed over time. Stick with us, won't you? You're listening to Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Miles Elam. He's a software engineer, political junkie. Hey, Miles.
How's it going?
Quite well, thank you. And also, Mr. Brian Young. He's a software engineer and an owner of a rehabilitating trailer.
Yeah. No. I think the trailer owns me. But yes, I'm happy to be here.
What kind of trailer is it?
It is a 1978 Leighton RV trailer, which is 22 or 25 years old. It's basically a wooden box with a sheet woven over it.
Okay. And may I ask you, what have you not worked on?
The bathroom. And that's probably the biggest problem because it's mocking me, saying this needs to be done someday.
Was there anything working with this thing when you bought it?
Everything was working. It just happened to have the equivalent of the foundation was falling down. The bottom support board was completely rotted through, so the entire shell of it wanted to slide down to the ground. Not very good when you're driving.
No, not very good when you're sitting still either. So you've basically rebuilt the entire shell. You resurfaced it. You've painted it.
We had to lift the box off of the trailer, slip a new floor under it, and put it back, which also involved taking just about everything out of it.
And now you're doing what, plumbing?
Plumbing. Modern, light, PEX plumbing.
PEX plumbing. I just recorded a video recently for the patrons and talked about how you used to do copper and solder, and now PEX. It's just so much easier.
Yeah.
Years ago, in fact, what do you figure out, Miles? It was April of 2009. Mm-hmm. We had a police officer in from San Jose, the police department, and he talked to us about many things on air about being safe and secure and such. This is 2009. And then I believe it was off air. He started talking to us about this database that they had and a whole bunch of the police cars. They may have 3 or 4 police cars that were recording license plate all the time and with their capturing the location and time and what license plate the camera saw.
And specifically going through mall parking lots.
Yes, and driving where lots of people were to kind of keep a record for researching post crimes, you know. And as he told us this, he was very nonchalant about it. You and I had our eyes all wide, like, this is not a good thing at all.
Well, I don't know if it was so much a knee-jerk, this is not a good thing. It was more along the lines of, how is this done? Because it could be done okay.
Who has access to this data? Do you have to have a warrant to use it?
Yeah, is it only a push of all of the stolen cars, and so it compares against
just
those,
scan
or
those,
are
right?
You scanning all of them and sending them back with location data back to a central location?
Like, and he said the latter, recording all and sending them back to a special location, but he said there was safeguards in place with this data.
Yeah, and then our eyes got wide.
Yeah. And then, of course, this was 2009, and over time, I've just assumed that got more and more. Now all cars do that. All police departments do that. That's just a standard thing, which is a little disturbing. But luckily, the data is completely safe, and it'll never be misused. In 2017, 22 law enforcement employees across California lost their jobs after abusing the computer network that grants police access to criminal histories, driving records, and according to data compiled by the California Attorney General's Office. So I don't know if this is also that system, but in general, we had like 143 violations of database rules. Basically, a police officer just had access to data and used it in an inappropriate way. Being prosecuted, though, the Attorney General says, we're finally taking data abuse seriously. So let's see, 2009, 2018. Good timing. Anyway, I thought it was good that they covered this. This was sent in to me via Twitter. Thank you so much. If you'd like to post news stories to us, please feel free to just tag GeekSpeak tweets or any of us. I'm Lyle on Twitter, and Miles is Miles Elam, and Brian is Brian Cordan Young. So you just have to spell all that out, and you'll get our Twitter handles.
I kind of feel like that is the timeline for when we got onto Twitter. Twitter was just beginning, and you're like, hey, Lyle's available. I took a little bit longer, and it's like, oh, Miles isn't available. Okay, my full name is Miles Elam. And Brian, I'm sure, went on there and went, oh, Brad's not available. Brian Cordan, oh, that might be too. Okay. Brian Cordan, oh, hey, that one's available. Yeah,
you got to pull out all three names to get on there. I was really late. I think it was, 2009?
And we all lack imagination, and it's actually just our names rather than something.
You know, I've been a long proponent of using your real identity. I'm pretty strong against that. But of course, I'm a pretty privileged person in society, so it's safe for me to do that. But you guys do the same thing online? Do you have pseudonyms?
I don't use pseudonyms, but I realize this about myself. I am bland and vanilla. I use my real name. I also, when I first got a Mac way back when, I made every icon represent what it did. My word processor looked like a typewriter. And I was so literal with everything. It was terrible. It was totally boring.
So your name is literally your name.
Yeah, I know. Well, what's fun in that?
That's fine. I used to have a pseudonym that I used everywhere, and now I just don't.
It's still your Twitter handle, isn't it?
No, not the Twitter handle.
The tech form known as Elam.
Yeah, it's a... might be GitHub that I'm still using that.
I think it's GitHub that you're using that, yeah. Greg from Canada, who supports us on the show, also says, real name. So I guess we're just all boring and plain vanilla.
We're privileged white men.
Miles used to be interesting. All right.
Then I hung out with white men too much.
You did. We ruined you. Tell us what, Miles, tell us what Microsoft is releasing. Or just released, actually.
The OpenStreetMap is a mapping technology, or not technology, but database. That is similar to Google Maps, only it's not licensed to Google. It's
kind of like the Wikipedia for map information.
Yes. But it does lag behind, for example, Google Maps in a few different ways. One of those ways had Apple restop and go, okay, we need to redo our maps because this just isn't working for us. Microsoft is actually releasing 125 million building footprints. In the U.S. only, but building footprints for the OpenStreetMap database.
Oh, cool. How'd they get that data?
Through Bing Maps.
Okay. So they've been researching and investing for a while, and they decided to make that all open source. Well, I wonder why.
Taking that with Bing Maps and then doing some, applying some algorithms, some machine learning algorithms to figure out the outlines to buildings, and then take the outlines to buildings and... then figure out, okay, this is where this is, this maps to this address.
Cool. It's good because, you know, you think of like when we go and use Google Maps and you turn on the building footprint stuff, you see like Google Earth data where you're seeing like surfaces and also all those layers. You think of that as like, oh, wow, we just have this information. But of course, all that information is very much owned by Google. So when you want data like that, getting it in a free way is a little challenging.
Right.
That's cool.
Although Google does have more than just the footprint. It has, for example, how tall the building is, and so full 3D rendering that's amazingly accurate and how they've mapped it on.
I think they've also picked up data from, you know, I think they've also scraped governmental records data, like building permits, things of that nature. But I could be wrong. It could be all just picked up from visual inspection.
Yeah. Do we know where Microsoft got all of this data in the sense that I know I've seen Google cars driving around doing street mapping.
I bet there was 3 or 4 Bing cars driving around.
Well, and I know the Apple vans driving around here. There's a story recently, just this week, that they are doing a whole revamp using their own data and not using other parties like TomTom.
There is that, but there's also satellite data, which is publicly available. So they may have used that to find the outlines.
Yeah,
very easily. That would be what I would do if I was...
Speaking of Microsoft, just recently, a couple weekends ago, I played around with a HoloLens. I got to use it and see... this is the augmented reality lens by Microsoft. And the visor looks really ridiculous, and it doesn't feel very good. It's a little heavy. But as a early stage but mass-produced product, it's pretty impressive. The image locking and spatial awareness locking stuff was flawless. It did not make me sick. It just felt like the object was in the room. There was slight drift, I would say, if you moved around the room and then back to the same spot you were in, but it was subtle enough.
What was drifting?
So, like a position, something would be locked in a position. You'd leave the room and come back. That position might be slightly different than it was before. Now, this could also be perceptual. Like, maybe it was just me. Maybe I was a little taller the next time, but I tried to put my head against the wall a certain way, look what it was like, then leave, then come back, and so on.
You were saying that you weren't feeling any nausea or motion sickness it, and at the same time, it's showing you the real world just with things
superimposed
on top of it, which doesn't seem to me anywhere near the same type of motion sickness you would get from creating a whole new world from whole cloth.
Virtual reality.
Yeah, where I see a difference there.
Yeah, no, I didn't mean to infer that augmented reality would cause nausea at all. It's just that it seemed so there. I mean, the thing that was very noticeable was that the UI was horrible. They went with gestures. They went with just your hand gestures is all you need to do. So you take your left or right hand and kind of you close your fingers except for your pointer and your thumb, and then you snap them together. And that represents grabbing something. So you're doing this kind of like clip, clip, clip thing with your fingers, and it doesn't always register. And additionally, you have a reticule. When you hover over something that's supposed to be something you can select, like you can move the objects around the room. There's a whole bunch of objects pushed around the room. All the friends in that space had tried it, and everybody put objects all over the place. So above the cat is like a skull. So I wanted to move the cat. The skull was slightly too far back, and I wanted to move it forward in 3D space from where I was standing. And so as you look at it, there's like a little tiny dot, dot, dot in front of it. And if you hover your center of gaze over that, you get a reticule. And then that little dot, dot, dot expands into a button, and it says like modify or delete, I can't remember. So then you have to, while that reticule is kind of hovered over that, you know, move button, you then do a snapping finger with your fingers. And so the fingers don't have to snap where you're seeing. They just have to snap kind of in front of you. In any case, you finally get it, and then it's about moving around. And then from moving around, you actually are holding with your fingers, and you're moving back and forth. The whole thing was just clunky and odd. It wasn't like the experience I've had with AR. But of course, with AR, you're normally using like paddles that have really good positioning and really good finger control.
AR or VR, you mean?
VR.
So what about the display technology? The one thing I've always heard about HoloLens is that it's only putting an image in the area of right immediately in front of your eyes, and there's no peripheral.
Yeah,
if you took
like a standard paperback book and put it arm's reach in front of you, no, like a larger book, put it maybe 8.5 by 11 piece of paper, and put it arm's reach in front of you, that's the viewing angle you have. So anything outside that has nothing, you just see through it.
Right.
Normally. And then anytime you have that over the space, you see it, which means objects are being clipped all the time.
Yeah. But what about the how does it handle blocking light? In other words, is it only superimposing light over top of what you see, or can it actually block brightness from behind the image?
I was in a dark mountain home, so I don't know. I didn't test that. They were talking about another effect that I didn't actually get to play with, which was monsters crawling out of the wall. And she had said that it's kind of challenging on a wall with lots of material on it, lots of things, because they occlude and they don't occlude, and they're kind of awkward. I don't know if it blocks light at all. I don't know if it's just added if you have to use a dark environment. I didn't play with it enough. It was about 20 minutes, and we were off to another party. So that's my take on HoloLens. So let's go ahead and talk about the wonderful things Linux is doing for humanity.
It's not a new thing that Linux is found on supercomputers, the top supercomputers out there, also known as the top 500 supercomputer list. It is, however, the first time that Linux has shown up as being on every one of the top 500 supercomputer lists.
They all run
Linux now. There was IBM's AIX, I believe, was a stalwart at the near the bottom end of that 500, but it's now been pushed off. And another curious thing about it is CPUs don't really define its computing power anymore. It's heavily dominated by GPUs now.
Right. I thought that's been like that for a long time. But in any case, all Linux-based.
Every last one of them.
Let's talk about simpler applications. Brian, you want to take us back a little bit?
First of all, I'm a little bit frustrated with the state of just the tools that I use these days. And we're going to get into that, but I want to take us back all the way to the earliest time of our computing days. What was the first app or program you can ever remember using?
Well, let's see. We had a VIC-20, which is a precursor or a cheaper version of a Commodore 64. I think it actually came out afterwards. And I recall we had paddles, and there was a seesaw game where it was called Clowns. Clowns would jump off the sides, and you'd have both players had kind of paddles and a seesaw, and then you'd have to jump the clowns back and forth. And then that game got pretty boring pretty quick, and I think I recall writing BASIC on that thing and writing little games to make color transformations out. What about you, Miles? First program ever, or first program you ever used?
Blackjack. BJack was the name of the program on the Exidy Sorcerer in 1970. Well, my dad bought it in 1978. I probably first used it in 1979.
So no graphics.
It was text-based graphics. So, I mean, they were...
Are you 4 years old at this time?
5.
Okay.
Yeah. I guess I was 4 when I first started doing it. Yeah. But yeah, the graphics were not ASCII characters. They were a graphical textual set that was very popular on computers of the era.
What about you, Brad?
Oh, the text-based adventures of the day. There was a graphics game I played on my TSR-80 that was a Dungeons and Dragons kind of game where you could actually, it drew 3D lines to give you an idea of the space. Not that it animated through it, but it would redraw each block as you went down.
My grandparents had an Apple II and then an Apple II Color. And I recall playing Choplifter, which was like a flying game, which is
pretty... Choplifter.
Choplifter.
Yep.
Never knew how it was pronounced. Choplifter, which was kind of an Ann Logan's... Loadrunner.
So what do you remember about these games or about the computers in general? When I think back then, I remember that when I hit a key, things changed on the screen instantly. There was no delay. Even though the computers were slow as molasses compared to today, the apps that ran on it, they instantly responded to what you were doing.
They didn't have much else to do.
No, they didn't. There was no operating system to slow it down.
Re-index your entire hard drive every few minutes?
There was no multiprocessing, no AV, no...
Not reconnecting to Wi-Fi?
In fact, we were talking about earlier that most of us remember typing in programs in the beginning.
Sure.
Out of magazines.
Yeah.
So,
and not being able to save them. And you restart your computer and it's gone. I remember that our friend sent us a tape deck for our VIC-20. So that after I copied down the big program that could allow you to play keyboard music, basically, synthesizer, I could then save it to an analog cassette tape. And that thing was great because it had an audio coupler of some sort. And you could hear the sound. It was great. Anyway, go on.
Yeah, and every once in a while it would fail.
Oh, it would fail all the time. You know, one of my early memories of that, though, is I remember the first Macintosh I played was like a 512 at some friend's house. And it was a boyfriend of my sister. And I stayed up all night long. It was dawn by the time somebody got to me. And I was just drawing some big landscape of some sort on Mac Paint. And by pixel by pixel, no, you know, just like the pencil tool, just a really slow. And I still remember like months later thinking if I could ever get that picture because I wanted a print of it. I had no print of it. So my first real memory of computers is really about creating something and then losing it. Like, I think that's why I'm so so careful about backups.
Well, the reason why I bring all this up and the reason why we go down memory lane is I've actually followed a number of stories for a few years now that I've never brought up on the show. And they've just been little mentions here and there about how apps just are not great nowadays. There was a thread of conversation over the past couple of years about how Apple is just, the software is falling apart and is not as good as it used to be. And I don't want to get into that, whether it's true or whether it's not, or whether there's some other mechanism of perception going on. But what I did notice is when you think back to the early days of computing, for at least us, apps were really responsive. And we, as Greg says in the chat here, we didn't even call them apps back then. They were just programs. An operating system was the thinnest layer to get the computer running, to get your programs up and running. And we went through this whole arc where originally they were text-based. If they had graphics, every single app, every single program had different conventions.
And the people that wrote the program wrote their entire graphics layer. They had to.
Yeah.
There was no like library they could pull in to generate text. They were just writing it by hand.
Well, you had a target. You had a target of like Hercules Monochrome, CGA, mm-hmm. EGA, VGA, and that was the spec you went for, like the Visa graphics standard, rather than a particular particular device driver for a card. And Windows changed that a lot, where you were now writing for a Windows drawing API instead of the video card API. The
added abstraction, yeah.
Yeah, and when we think about apps and UI, the big shift was when the Macintosh came out. Even though not a lot of people used them, this whole idea that you can standardize not only the graphics drivers or the printer drivers, but you can standardize the way we use the computer so we don't have to relearn every application every time.
Like the file menu. Like a concept of a window, the close button always being the same place, that kind of stuff.
If you know how to print in one app, you know how to print in another app. And there's a huge long heritage of this, obviously. You can look at Photoshop today and still see the marks of the earliest Photoshop that was released in, I think it was 89. And I think we had a good 10, 15 years where this uniformity that really helped us be more productive and able to use an application really helped. Computers were slow. We had to wait for disk drives. We had to wait for all sorts of things. We had to swap floppies just to get a different app running sometimes. But the way you use the computer was helping you and making you more efficient. In fact, the reason why I love the Macintosh, especially through the dark days of the 90s, was how scripting and other aspects of the Mac, if you added a new app to your computer, it didn't just help you do with what that app could do. You could start using it together with other apps.
With like AppleScript?
With either AppleScript or just the way you could open the same file up in a different application and do something different with it and start tying things together.
Immediate follow-up. Photoshop version 1.0 came out in February of 1999, but 0.07 came out in January of 1988. So I say that, yes, you got 88 correct for Photoshop. Congratulations.
Yes. The thing about computing, our computers are so massively faster than they were in those days when Photoshop first came out. And yet, I'm sitting here and using apps that are not keeping up with me, even on these incredible computers. And it's not just about how these programs are written and running. It's about how they're designed and how software engineering and market forces are affecting how software is written. So we had this period where Windows and Mac was very uniform and the UIs helped us use a different application even though we'd never used it before. Then we hit a period of an explosion of different technologies. First, there was Java, and Java allowed us to have these cross-platform apps, but the UI wasn't quite the same as everything else. And then we hit the period of web apps. At first, they were nothing like any other apps, but as the web matured and the technology matured, they got more powerful. But even today, web apps that I use have so many conventions that are all over the place that I can't trust that any web app is going to work like any other application I use. And we're at the point where web apps are wrapped into a desktop wrapper. And
What do you mean look like a desktop app?
So,
or have a skin to run on the desktop.
Yeah, for example, Slack.
Yeah. We use Slack every show. But it doesn't have the same conventions as any other desktop app. It has a web app convention.
Right. It doesn't fit the Macintosh operating system, doesn't fit the Windows operating system.
And not only do you have to relearn what the user interface is, you can't trust that it'll just tie into the rest of the operating system conventions like any other application that's truly native might.
Hmm.
And of course, we've had decades of arguing what is native and what is important about being native.
Earlier, you suggested that we might have this topic, and so I looked up, I wanted to get the name of LoadRunner and such, and so I grabbed, I found, searched LoadRunner and found a web app of LoadRunner, which is like a complete duplication of it. It seemed exactly the same. It had the same sound effects and everything. That's one running the web. So at some level, what we could do back in the day, we can do so easily, we don't. But
yeah, and it runs pretty snappy?
Oh, it's flawless, yeah.
Yeah.
Completely responsive. I was able to dissolve the ground in front of the bad guys really easily. So are you saying that this software was better at one point? Or are you saying that we've created too much richness to a point of uselessness? I mean, what's your argument here?
I feel like the tools are getting in the way more than they're helping these days. And the best analogy I can think of is when I'm sitting there in my previous job, I used a number of different web apps, project management apps and
mass mailing apps.
Yeah, well, marketing automation apps. They're there to
help. I call them mass mailing.
Well, they are, but they do all these things for you that are supposed to make it faster. But in reality, I sit there waiting for the device, waiting for the program so much that I feel like I'm stuck in traffic. Mm. I'd rather take a country road, do a little bit more myself, but feel like I'm getting somewhere.
Nice metaphor. I get what you're saying at some level. It does feel like sometimes you're waiting. I do a lot of compiling of the Netflix app, right? So it compiles on my machine. And when you're using Objective-C, you've got to keep compiling when you want to make changes. So I'll spend, like, all day today I didn't do any compiling because I'm refactoring a giant bit of code. And towards the end of the day, I wanted to test one of the stages and started compiling it. I was like, oh yeah, I'm waiting. And even though it's not that long of a wait, I do hear what you're saying.
Yeah, because there's a flow you get into when you're doing something, especially if you're doing something professionally, where you want to stay in that mindset of what you're doing. You don't want anything to make you come out of it. If you have to sit there and wait for the app to catch up with you, your mind's going to wander.
Do you think that the apps are not being written in such a way to make them crisp and clean and fast? Or do you think that people aren't spending the time they used to spend? Like, what do you think's causing this?
Oh, there's a lot of forces. A lot of them is just how software is funded these days. Mm-hmm. So Slack is a good example in that it's a very successful company. It ballooned up and exploded, 2 years ago?
Sure.
And they did a strategy that is pretty typical these days of focusing on a cross-platform technology to reuse resources so that they don't have to hire a complete team of both Mac and iOS and Android. They want to efficiently use their resources.
Slack's a chatting application, by the way. We use it for GeekSpeak for planning and such, and we collect news stories and things through it. So it's kind of you can kind of think of it as like a Facebook Messenger on steroids.
Yeah, and throughout technology, we've had this quest for making apps in a way that are cross-platform, that you don't have to re-engineer every time you want to go to another platform.
Yeah.
Going back to Java. But they're not, the forces are not allowing for the engineers to make something that is going to be a really great experience on the platform that they're making it for. Mm. They just want to get their individual take on what they're doing, in this case, a chat app, a collaboration app. They want to get that to as many people as possible, but they're not concerned about making sure it works into their flow of their operating system.
Meaning, like, they build a great chat application, and Slack is a really great chat application, especially when you start using the key commands and stuff. I use it all the time. We use it at work, too. And I get that. And what you're saying is they're making the app kind of the same app across all services.
Sure.
Determining as much as possible. And what you're saying is that might not fit well with the expected experience like on a Mac user would have.
Right.
Because I feel like, are there complaints about Slack because every once in a while it disconnects and then it's kind of broken for a little while until you reconnect. But when I'm regularly during the day, I'm flowing through key commands and I flow pretty well in that app now because I've learned how to modify myself to it.
Yeah, exactly. You've learned how to adapt yourself, and it's not allowing you to work the way you want to work necessarily.
Yeah, that's an interesting problem, though, right? Because that's true. In general, I've taken the tact long ago, whatever the operating system is suggesting to be the pattern of use, I modify myself to that pattern. Because I found that over time, if you hold on to some idea that this is the way to do it, you're just going to bump into walls continually, and you're going to be doing it in a situation where you're frustrated a lot of the time.
Yeah, don't fight it.
Right. So, for example, the scrolling of a trackpad, I do the way Mac does it out of the box, even though that's reversed up and down scrolling from what it used to be. Which way do you do it?
Oh, I switched over as soon as Mac did it that way.
Miles, what about you? Trackpad, you swapped as well.
Yep.
I think it's partly going along with that flow is a beneficial. Is there anything you guys are stuck on in an old form that you still do, even though it's against convention?
There's only one thing like that, and this comes from...
I know what it is.
Do you?
Yeah, it's your use of labels.
No, that's a modern thing. What do you mean? People aren't catching up with me yet.
Okay, sure. What was it?
I agree with you. No one doesn't.
No one doesn't.
No. Back in 98, No, 99. I worked on a Linux machine. No, I'm sorry. It was an IRIX machine. It was a Silicon Graphics machine. I don't know what the window manager was, but the one notable thing about it was it had cursor follow. So if I'm using my mouse cursor and I hover over a window, it wouldn't pop the window forward, but it would put the focus on that window. So wherever my mouse arrow was on the screen, if I typed, it would type into that window.
Oh, interesting.
So like I said, it doesn't pop it forward. Yeah. If it's behind a three other windows, it's still behind it, but my keystrokes are going to go to that. It was so fast and so efficient. And
you still do that?
Yeah, I can't get out of the
habit. How do you set yourself up to do that?
You can't do it on a Mac.
Oh, okay.
The Mac window manager will not allow this. And I have made so many mistakes where I have sent the wrong message to the wrong person, to the wrong window, to the wrong system, all because of this. It works so well for me, I can't get myself out of it.
That's good. That's really interesting. Miles, anything you stuck on old conventions of computer usage?
Yeah, I still use a text editor to program instead of an IDE.
What language are you programming in?
JavaScript.
What text editor are you using?
At the moment, I'm using BBEdit.
That's a great. That's my first text editing. That's the first software I ever bought. Good software. Actually, also the first swag I ever got because I produced a website for the company I was working for at the time, the Innovonics Inc., which is in Felton, and I bought Innovon.com early on. Same time as I bought my own last name, and I put up a site and I put on the very bottom their badge built with BBEdit, and they sent me a T-shirt. I stole that T-shirt.
Nice.
Yes.
I downloaded VS Code. People keep talking about it, and I've been trying it.
Just, what about syntax highlighting? Does BBEdit have syntax highlighting for JavaScript?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It doesn't have it for Swift.
Are you sure about that?
Well, maybe there's a third-party one, but it's not built in.
Oh, okay.
Wait, you don't like MS Code? Microsoft Code? VS Code? MS
yeah,
Code.
Yeah, Visual Source Code. Yeah.
Oh, man, it's such a good app. What's wrong with you? What about linting? Do you have, like, linting? Do you have, like,
yeah.
What, you're running all that
stuff? That's okay. The thing, though, is, like, for example, the Node app. I installed ESLint in there. I run it as part of the test process. So I go npm test, and it runs ESLint. And then if the lint passes, then it runs the test. And then I get...
You just need
and
to
then
sit down
I
with
run
really
NYC, which is the report that comes at the end of it. So it's the switch. Like, I edit in one program, and then I, you know, run tests and deploy from...
My go-to application when I don't think about it and just open something to edit text or make a token note, whatever, is Sublime. I work with my... JavaScript, we're moving over to Node for backend services right now. And so I work in JavaScript in MS Code, Visual Code, whatever it's called. And sometimes I'll open Groovy files with that. I also use IntelliJ for Groovy. And then, of course, I'm using Xcode for iOS. So, yeah, I'm in complete mishmash all the time.
Oh, yeah.
And all those things have different key commands and everything. And I use the key commands for each one of them. I don't change the default key commands for anything. So... I'm dyslexic at work, effectively.
Yeah, and it's part of being a professional that you have to be able to do that. But what if the world wasn't so chaotic and so creative? What if we didn't have even mobile apps, which have almost no conventions? They come as a complete world unto themselves.
As a mobile developer for the last 4 years, there's a lot of mobile conventions, but... Go on.
No, but compared to the days of the purists of Mac and Windows in the early days, where the idea was to follow those conventions slavishly so that you could easily open up a new app. I think this idea of just being able to open up an app and be able to get 50% of the way there with all the conventions is gone. There's no way we're ever going to get back to the point where there's that much uniformity.
I agree.
It's done. That day is gone. And it's great to have a lot of creativity. It's great to have new ideas.
Let me ask you, though. I mean, how many apps do you actually use in a week?
Oh, goodness.
On your computer, it's probably 10. And on your phone,
I'm sure
it's probably
about
15, 30
or 40. 30.
Oh, quite a few.
No, I jump around all the time.
Okay.
All sorts
well,
of
that's
things.
The problem.
It is. It is the problem. But in my dream world of the early days where things were snappy and things were... no, they were.
When you were doing one thing at a time.
I know, but they all fed into
and
each
you
other.
You couldn't download anything because there was no internet.
but where's software going now? What does an app mean now, and what's it going to mean in another 5 or 10 years? What are apps for?
For the goal at hand.
Yeah.
Let's take an app that I work on, for example. The Netflix application, we have multiple versions of it, right? We have it on the Windows and Android and you name it, it's there. It's on your TV and everything. Those are all different teams and all different code bases and all different designers kind of working together. When I go on to that app, I use a lot. When I go into that app versus like Amazon Prime Play or HBO, these are all like, or YouTube, these are all like, get on the service, find something you want to watch, and watch it. There's not much complexity. The full screen version of all those is pretty much the same. It's a video playing, right? And then if you tap, you get a pause and maybe a skip forward button and such. Those apps, the goal of them is so close that there's never a time where I'm confused or lost. One might be a little snappier. One might allow me to continue where I was before a little better. But in general, I'm not like I'm lost or confused or feel like I'm missing something on any of them. Well, maybe one of them or two of them.
Yeah, well, there are plenty of mobile apps out there that have a problem with discovering how to do things.
I was talking about one domain, though.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we talk about programs and apps as a generic thing, but in reality, there's all these different problem scopes you want to solve, right?
Right.
If you're dealing with lots of numbers or small sets of numbers that you humanly want to manage, you're going to get a spreadsheet application. The reason why the spreadsheet applications all have the same functionality and basically are completely the same in most ways is that that's the one we've settled on. So, like, if you open... what is it? Numbers in OS X, Microsoft Excel, of course, and then
Google Sheets,
which is just winning. Pretty much all of those are the same.
Right.
Like, you can do anything on all of them that you can do on any of
them. Yeah, Microsoft Excel is noticeably ahead.
Well,
it handles
what I can do. I'm not saying what everybody can do.
Okay.
And besides, no, Google Sheets? No,
is not on par. I love Google Sheets. I use Google Sheets. It is not... the same thing.
All right, pull up local stocks and weather in Microsoft Excel. Oh, you couldn't do that? Oh, you can in Google Sheets. Any case, and also there's an API for it, so you can interface with it in programming languages.
What does that have anything to do with a spreadsheet? No, honestly, your local weather. What does that have to do with 99.999%
weather
of all
was just an
spreadsheets?
Example. But, you know, I have a Google Sheet spreadsheet where I can go up and see my stock numbers all the time. And they're actually my figures, each, you know, option set and everything. And that number is a live number that updates all the time.
Okay, that's
kind of
cool. Yeah.
That's something you can't do in Google. Well, you probably can use Microsoft online. Microsoft I just haven't used in a long time. But the point is that in domains, there's like a solution that seems to work and stick. And I don't feel confused. A good photo app has the features I want. A lighter one doesn't have as many of the features, but never am I like really confused. So it feels like I don't know what we're missing here by having the conventions follow the domain of knowledge rather than the operating system.
Well, I think one of the ways that I really miss is the fact that on Mac between the 95 to 2005 period, I was able to tie apps together. Through the scripting, through different ways to pipe one source into another tool. And this is largely slipped away because scripting has fallen out of favor and apps aren't supporting it.
Well, there's also a lot more apps out there.
There's a lot more apps
out
there.
So let's talk about that scripting and piping stuff. The end-all be-all of that paradigm is the Unix operating or any Unix operating system, right? Where you can literally pipe things.
Right, right. That's the best manifestation that has existed. There's been other ideas that never quite came to fruition, like I'm going to forget the name of OpenDoc was early Apple technology that
had similar ideas.
Well, it had the idea that apps would go away, and on a single document, you could have multiple tools that contribute to it and can edit their aspect of it. So it was like the idea of the app melts away and the document becomes center and you can do multiple things with a single document.
So last year around this time, I was doing some development on iOS and I was debugging some stuff and I needed to really parse some logs well. And we can turn our log leveling on very strong. So like everything that happens on the app just spits down all this data. And when you don't want a human parse that data, so you need to clear it out. You need to look at it. You need to analyze. You need to search it and things like that. So I grabbed a utility that basically took that pipe of stream of content and threw it into a terminal access so that I could in the, you know, Unix base core, I could pipe all that to my grep functions and my cat functions and basically sort and order and count and get data out of it. So I spent a lot of time doing this kind of middle layer scripting language that allowed me to run things and find things, and it helped my problem. That whole piece that I wrote was a custom application written in these little building blocks that, as a long-term Unix user, you just know. And you look up and figure out with man pages and such. But if I instead had spent my time and energy going and finding a company that had written a really good application to look at that data, I probably could have built that quicker, and it would have been prettier, and I would have kept that and saved it. It wouldn't have been this ethereal thing that was just in my command line history. So I don't know what's better. I mean, at some level, as long as you can people can program and they're empowered to program and make good solutions to problems, isn't that more valuable than piecemeal stuff ad hoc when you want to?
Well, yes and no. If it fits your exact needs, then it's absolutely perfect. And isn't that the goal of every software developer, is to fit the needs of so many people that they can make a business out of it? But the truth is how individual we all are and our needs, and the fact that we're going to bend the use of an app into what we want it to be as much as we can, means that so many of these apps don't fit the direct use case that they were made for us.
Can we talk about audio editing software now? Because you're like right in my gambit here.
Yeah, go for it.
All right. So I use, to edit the podcasts I work on, I use Adobe Audition. And I have that because I've had Photoshop forever, and it's come part of the suite that you get monthly. So Adobe Audition is a multi-track editing software. Miles and Brian and I all have microphones in our faces. They're SM58 clones, which are standard mics. They have pretty good audio. There is some crosstalk in the room because we're not in a perfect sound room. Miles' laptop is kind of loud tonight, and I think my daughter is doing laundry in her room, so you might be able to hear that. But I take all these three tracks, and I put them in an audio editor, and because they're all recorded at the same time on my HS Zoom, there's a YouTube video showing my equipment if you're interested, by the way. I'll link to it in this show. The WAV files that I'm saving, when I put them in, they're all synced fine. And when I want to try to edit and work on things, let's say we all speak over each other a little bit, and I might want it, like Miles' joke was funnier, so I drop my voice out. That happens a lot, by the way. When I want to do that, I can control my track only. And I can also shift all the tracks over to make space for Miles' phrase so that I can have my phrase after that. In doing that, though, Adobe Audition does not allow me to lock those audio files in any way. So I can lock them, but then I can't edit. I want to just say, you know, tie these three tracks together. Don't let me mess with them unless I change the mode to say, now I can slide them around. Because if I get them slightly ajar from each other, it sounds like we're in a big echoey chamber, because the reverb effect will kick in because all these mics are kind of picking up the other person's voice. That's been a bee in my bonnet for like 4 years. I hate it. I don't know of another app that can do this. I've looked around, tried to figure it out, but okay, that's one thing. The next thing is that it doesn't have a lot of features that would just be like inherently a good idea. For example, sometimes, and it's not frequent, we have silence. When we have silence, there's no reason to not pull that silence out. When somebody takes a thought, whatever, wants to take a break, I don't go in there normally and break down silences. I'll take out sometimes of us and such, but I'm not going to take that silence and just like go in there and spend time to get that, you know, 0.7 seconds down to half a second. It's just no reason. But it would be very easy to have software that did that. So, little pet peeves of the software. I recently started using an iPad application, which is amazingly cool, and I will put in the show notes, that does some of these things as well. It also doesn't let me lock the tracks. Because most people edit with like one mic in a room or something, or they edit with people in two different spaces. And if you're in two different physical spaces, there's no crosstalk on the mics, and you can move around the voices anytime you want. So that was kind of fun. But the thing that I was missing for all these is we're speaking English, and we don't have a giant vocabulary, and there's voice-to-text code that exists on all of our phones and everywhere in our lives. Transferring our words to actual text words is trivial. So in the last month, I've been thinking I should write an application that basically tokenizes all the audio that we're speaking. And when I say the word "the," a word "the" would show up and be highlighted in a text editor, and you'd select that text and you could delete it, and it would delete that part of the waveform. So I was working on it the last few days, trying to figure out what to do. And yesterday I finally pulled together the speech recognition's part of iOS and got it working so I could start seeing that. And then it was like getting late last night, and I was like, yeah, someone's probably done this. Let's see what else is out there before I spend too much time developing this. So I go online, and I found the application that does exactly that.
No kidding.
And it's really friggin' cool. It's called Descript. It's paid, and they pay by translation minute. So it's like 7 cents a minute of translation. And it really does give you this amazing experience where you're reading a text document, and as you're playing it, the words are being highlighted. You click on the word you delete it, and it deletes that part of the WAV file. It's amazing. It's expensive, unfortunately. It's going to cost me, you know, $15 an episode or something to do this, which is worth it because editing is hard. But 2 days ago, I decided that since we're not doing Geek Speak regularly, it would make sense for me to stop charging people monthly. I wasn't doing it weekly, so I'm not giving people 4 episodes. So I wrote this little, video recording. I turned off the Patreon page for Geek Speak, dropping all the revenue that I can pull in to help maybe pay for software that would be nice every week, with the idea that there's no reason for me to feel guilty about not producing the content every show, just every week. So just do it once a month or whatever works. So this is a long way of saying I do want to use the software. It might make it easier to do editing of the show, but it's going to cost per episode. So if you wanted to be a patron, again, I did cancel everybody's patron. I now invite you to join us at geekspeak.org/support. And what you can do there is you can just give an amount of money per episode. I don't know when I'll make them, but every time I make one, you'll contribute a little bit of money. This happens automatically on patreon.com, which is kind of cool. And you can even set a maximum per month. So you can just say, you know, I don't know, $5 a month, and every episode gets a dollar or whatever. So if you want to do something like that, that'd be great. If I can get that figure up to in the $50 range, then I can cover all the costs of GeekSpeak. Oh, wait, maybe more now because of the software. Anyway, I'll show you the software, Brian and Miles. It's really quite impressive.
And you don't need to tie any other apps in. It does everything you need.
So the thing that's amazing about it, and what you'll actually, this is great, it exports Adobe Audition multi-track files. So after you take the raw cut and get it all, then you can put it back in the editing suite that's actually good at doing the traditional stuff like adding the music beds or doing the compression and all the stuff that makes the audio sound a little sweeter. So it does good cross-integration.
Nice.
Here's the app. I'll just go ahead and play. This is an internal episode from Netflix.
Are you also being discreetly?
And if you were to take any of those highlighted words and just
delete.
It'll give you back a already edited waveform without that word.
Yeah, it really does work that well. I mean, there's definitely bugs in it. It's a group in San Francisco, and they're pretty impressive what they can do. There's definitely some problems, but here we'll play a little bit of phrasing. Let's see if we can hear a bit of the phrasing of it. I'll go ahead and play this. It's going to have an in there, so just listen for the
Yeah, actually, in sort of context.
So you hear that in there? So I'll just double click this and delete it, and we'll play it again.
Yeah, actually, in sort of content protection space.
So you heard there was an before that, and it really is just like text editing. It's amazing. So anyway, the company is called Descript, and unfortunately, it does cost a bit of money. Additionally, all the WAV files, and I'm going to have to switch away from WAV, get uploaded to Google for the translation, and then it comes back down. That's why it actually costs money per translation, because Google costs money for that service. And because of this podcast I was just showing, was actually the one I'm using right here, is actually an internal podcast. I now have this question of like, I shouldn't have sent that outside of Netflix and had it be processed somewhere else. So I have to rethink that for the internal ones. For the public podcast, though, it's a perfectly valid tool to use. Of course, this could be done on my computer. It doesn't have to be done in the cloud. And because there's enough bugs, I might build my own.
So I want to talk about that on your computer versus the cloud thing, because I was talking about apps the way that we know them now, but we're approaching a possible big change in what apps mean. Already, if you look on mobile, apps are being broken into smaller parts. Android apps, you're not necessarily downloading the full app. You're downloading a sort of starter piece, and it's pulling down the pieces it needs.
iOS supports that now too, bundled.
Yes, and iOS does that. In fact, iOS technologies are encouraging developers to break their apps into smaller pieces so that the extension can run and do much of the what an app can do without bringing up the whole interface. It's just dealing with the data of the app and presenting you the extension share sheet.
And, you know, this highly focused version of the app kind of thing is exactly why Facebook has Facebook and Facebook also has Messenger. And when they want to communicate with each other, they communicate with each other. So it's they're building in that protocol. I mean, the operating system now is supporting some of that protocol, of course, but definitely companies are taking advantage of that to make a more specialized app that's not cohesive as like a Photoshop, for example, that can do everything under the sun. By the way, we were talking about whether iOS on the iPhone X could actually handle voice dictation and actually get translation going. And here's a little demo app that I'm offline on that phone, so you can go ahead and have it record. You just speak something.
So everything I'm saying is being translated from speech to text directly on the device.
Now. Great. I'll just do a screen capture of that. So anyway, it's not perfect by any means, but it would totally be functional for this kind of editing where you don't need perfect words. You just need a representation of the text so you can select words and delete them.
Right. So I want to wrap up this conversation. And you might be a little surprised where I'm going, but I'm going back to last week's episode where we were talking about what Apple's releasing with Siri shortcuts and the predictive machine learning aspect where it's trying to see what you do and then offer you at the next opportunity where it thinks you might want to do that again to suggest, do you want to start editing your podcast? It's Monday evening.
Right.
So in this world where we might be moving to a voice-operated world, where all of a sudden all this UI complaint stuff that I was talking about over the discussion melts away, and an app, what the code that is doing the tool work that you want to get done is being controlled through voice, it's going to have to be a lot different than what we think of it as an app today.
Like, what does it have to do to handle that?
Well, what I saw with the release of Siri shortcuts, and Siri is still and going to be for a while behind the other voice assistants, and the voice assistants that are out there are not at all to the point where they're as useful as we want them to be. But this idea that the system can monitor what you are doing and then say, I can take over that for you, or I know you're going to be doing this. Would you like me to do step A, B, C, and D, and string these multiple things together, which might be coming from multiple different apps, but it knows you want to do this because it knows you open up audio files, and then it knows you put it into the web app that breaks it up into small sound bites, and then it knows that it presents it to you where you can pull out the ums, and then it knows after you're done with that, it's going to go ahead and put it over here into an audio editing app that allows you to compress it and do the sweetening operations. If the system is watching every step you do, whether it's audio editing or whether it's your social networking or whether it's your...
collecting news for a talk show.
News for a show, project management. If the system is able to watch what you're doing, maybe even it's watching what your sleep patterns are. Maybe it's watching your travel patterns. And it can start suggesting these things. There's two things that come to mind. First of all, it's a...
Ew.
Sorry. First of all, it's a world that the system has to know a whole lot about you.
Yeah.
It has to know intimate details. And second of all, it has to be small, discrete parts that are tied together that can be chained because they're what it knows the user wants to do because it's seen you do this 100 times.
Do you think Apple producing this kind of new Siri shortcut AI augmented thing is a next stage in software?
Well, it's possible. I mean, we're not good at predicting the future. We know that. But I've been, after Apple released their announcements, I've been looking into this this world of people that are predicting what voice assistants are going to be like. And it really excited my imagination. Yeah. There's a guy named Brian Romilly. We'll link to an article of his. But this idea that we are not able to get as much out of our voice assistants right now because they don't have the context. They don't know that when we talk about going to the movies, we're actually talking about Scotts Valley Theater just 10 minutes up the road, because it doesn't know the history or the context of what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. But in a system where you have machine learning that's tracking what you're doing and trying to find patterns and then suggesting to you the things that it knows, it can build up that context. Hmm. But in a cloud-based world, that's a scary prospect. That's a lot of data in other people's hands.
Yeah.
In a world, if we're going to go to this, if developers are going to start building apps using machine learning to follow our patterns, we don't want it to be in a cloud-based world. We want it in a world where we know that our data is in our hands. Mm-hmm. I've actually been tracking my every movement everywhere I go for the last 6 months.
On your own server, right?
It's an app running on my phone that is sending the data only to my server, and I have complete control of it. I have the full history. And I was doing this years ago. I was doing this back when I got my iPhone 5S with an app called Move. And I loved it. It told me all sorts of things that were cool. I could see, I was at work for 8 hours, or, I did this much running. But Facebook bought them. Mm-hmm. And as soon as they did that, and they had even had an API for other apps to use that data. Well, whether they went away or not, I decided that if Facebook's going to have this company, they're going to have my data. This is just not the world I want to live in. We need to think about the technology that we're fostering here.
Yeah.
And if we're going to go into this world, it had better not be a world where big companies have huge amounts of our data.
AT&T or Sprint, Brian?
Yeah, AT&T.
Yeah, so they have where you are.
Oh, yeah. But do they know what ice cream I had today?
No, your phone knows that.
And do they know my sleep patterns?
No, maybe not. Facebook might. okay, cool. I think it's neat to hear that maybe an optimistic tone that there might be more inter-app communication at a smaller, granular level that does have that kind of beautiful quality of Web 2.0 era where, you know, everybody will share data in between each other and there'll be APIs and you can do anything you want. That does have that kind of feeling. I'm curious to what the motivations will be for companies to open up this data to share it more effectively for users.
Share the data or share the tools
interactions
as a discrete unit that can be used within a bigger system.
Right. So, for example, let's say a really great mask image overlay tool comes along and people start using it to submit stuff through Facebook Messenger. But of course, if Facebook can modify Facebook Messenger to have that feature, they'll add that because then the users won't leave their service. So it's very hard to get something that's going to stick outside of the ecosystem of a large corporation like Facebook or Google.
And history shows that if somebody makes something cool, the big companies will go in and make that cool thing for them as well.
Or buy them first. Yeah. Miles, how about we take your last story?
There's a hashtag that's been going around on Twitter called Families Belong Together. And that is part of the nationwide protest with regard to family detention and separation of families, kids from parents at the border. And what some researchers have found is that some bots have resurfaced in similar vein to the ones during the U.S. election. These ones are coming out and they are trying to pretend to be fully human, so trying to mimic general patterns, and they are using a hashtag that is slightly misspelled, so that when people want to actually write in Families Belong Together, they'll put in the hashtag and they'll start typing it and you'll get the autocomplete.
Or something else.
The autocomplete will end up being one of the misspelled ones to dilute the message of Families Belong Together.
So if you're following Families Belong Together tag and someone posts on Families Belong to Nether, then you don't see that other tag, and the message spreads less effectively.
Exactly.
Interesting.
Do they use Unicode?
I don't know, because that would be a lot easier to track.
That's true.
Spelling mistakes? Yeah, Americans are really bad at spelling. So finding just general typos, that's easier to cover your tracks.
Lyle, you're a real American.
I'm a real American. I'm a real boy. GeekSpeak is registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission, and GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, which means you can do anything you want with this. You can remix it, you can make money on it, just give us some credit. The title for today by Greg Merkley in Canada is Mapping Database Abuse with Better Apps. Thank you, Greg, for the title. Miles Elam, Brian Young, thank you so much for joining me today on Geekspeak.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah, it was great to be here.